Christmas Advent calendars. I asked Margo how long we've had Christmas Advent calendars around our home. She thinks the first one she bought was in Germany when the first Christmas we were there, and in fact she thinks they're German, and she doesn't think that she really even knew they had them. They are, of course, a countdown from December 1st to 24th, and they have different things, and they're coming out with really clever ones now. Some of them we've had with little boxes of toys in them and the like. This year we gave one to Emma Rose. It was a three-dimensional Advent calendar. We haven't seen it put together, and we're going over there, of course, this Christmas, and we'll get a chance to see it. This year we had a stained glass Advent calendar. It's really instructive and nice. The glass itself is 1390, which is quite old, isn't it? And from Vienna, the glass itself now is owned by the Cloisters in New York City. One thing that's instructive about it is, you know, we go look in a cathedral or whatever, look at some stained glass and say, oh, isn't that nice, and move on. But if you realize, if you just even look at one or two panels, and this is a four-panel set, how much information and the like is on there, if you just pause and look. So it's both fun and they're fun and instructive, and a nice kind of countdown at Christmas time. Your quiz for today, everyone knows there are black and white stained glass church windows. That's common knowledge, I'm sure, to all my listeners. But my question is, where are the most famous black and white Christian stained glass windows in Europe? Just name the cathedral, we'll be fine. I went to my barbershop this morning to get my pre-journey haircut. My barbershop has a name. It's called the Sport of Kings Barbershop. And it was pretty busy, actually. A woman owns it now. There were, I think, four young men in there getting haircuts, and I wondered how many knew, those four men, how many knew what is the Sport of Kings? What would they think that was? I'd be a little surprised if more than one knew. In any case, I said to this woman, the barber, I said, my goodness, how times have changed. I said, you know, you used to go into barbershops and they had things like Playboy magazine, Esquire magazine, Sporting News, that kind of thing. And I said, now your rack is filled with Working Woman, Better Homes and Gardens, and that kind of thing. I said, you don't see any girly magazines anymore. And she said, yeah, she said, I guess times have changed, haven't they? And I said, I guess they have. My haircut, by the way, cost $6. That's a senior trim, which I think is probably really reasonable for a haircut anymore. And I always give a dollar tip, so $7 for a haircut. I absolutely know I can remember 35-cent haircuts. I remember paying that fairly late, 35-cent haircuts. I think I kind of remember 25-cent haircuts, maybe in Florida. But yeah, 25-cent haircuts, and now you think it's quite reasonable to get away with $7. Concerning the Sport of Kings, Yakima has a racetrack, and now Seattle, or south of Seattle, has a beautiful, brand-new, world-class racetrack. But if you go to either of these tracks, and we've been to both, and you go down to the ground floor, don't go in upstairs where the bar and the fancy tables are at the clubhouse, but go down with on the rail, with what they call the Railbirds Hangout, which is a fun place to be. But now, Sport of Kings is filled with the third world. You know, it's all kinds of Orientals and well, you know, Filipino dishwashers and Chinese cooks and often with their families, and Mexicans like horse racing. And I think it's I don't know, I suppose it's something for nothing, but it's a long way from the Sport of Kings, at least in my limited experience. I was a little surprised, because I didn't know it, but Paula mentioned it, it seems to me, in passing sometime, either in a letter or whatever, that my mother liked horse racing. She liked to go to the track and place her $2 bets. I did not know that. I'm not surprised to hear that at all. And it doesn't seem like anything my father would do, but I'm sure she learned to do that after he died, I guess. I don't know. These are questions I have no way to, you know. You wish people were alive so that you could ask them questions like that. And in fact, maybe that's part of the reason we're making this tape. When we lived in Manhattan, Kansas, which was and we lived in a wonderful area of Manhattan, Kansas, not that it's that big a town. Manhattan, Kansas is a university town, Kansas State University, I think. So it's really I guess you could say, a college town, and there was a college community sort of thing, as you could maybe imagine, sort of part of the city associated with the college, and there was a main part of town, I don't know, 10 or 15 blocks away, I forget. Well, we moved there, they had just finished a world-class flood. Manhattan, Kansas was flooded up there at nostrils. But anyway, this was a nice part of town we lived in, and that's where I used to buy this 99 cents white Bordeaux wine from France. They had a wine store, and I'd go in and buy one bottle of 99 cent white Bordeaux French wine, which was wonderful. I loved it, so I thought I was a total cotton, which I was. Anyway, there was a real butcher shop there, and you know, they've died out fast, haven't they? But Kansas is beef country, of course, among other things. They raised a lot of cattle there. But we went in one time, the first time we went in there, we said, oh, we want a pound of hamburger or whatever. And said, do you have any lamb chops? He said, oh yeah, we have a lamb chop. So this guy went back in the freezer and he brought out this loin of lamb chops, and he said, how many you want? We said, we want two nice chops. He said, okay, and he put this frozen piece of meat under the bandsaw and cut us off a couple of chops. So, I don't know, a couple of weeks later, we went back and said, do you have any lamb? Oh, he said, oh yeah, no problem. You want some lamb chops? And he went back, so got this same leg of lamb. So we slowly ate. We were the only people in Manhattan, Kansas, I think, as far as I know, eating on this leg of lamb, which was probably dated from 1938, frozen back there. And we just take it. Well, two lamb chops, make them thick, you know. And, oh, yeah, no problem. And that is really, I think, a funny story. Mongo said I was remiss on the Sport of Kings story and omitting an important fact. So footnote 17, Sport of Kings. And that is, I love the track. I can't think of a better way to spend an afternoon to go betting on the ponies. I'm not that bad at it, and I'd love to hang down there and on the rail and root my winner or loser in, whatever. So I think the betting on horses is wonderful, and I'm sort of concerned that horse racing is slowly dying out in this country, giving up the more mindless activities like lotto. And so I do like horse racing. The first races I had a chance to see were trotters in upstate New York associated with the fair when I was about 14 years old. I didn't bet anything. I didn't even realize exactly that maybe betting was going on. I'm not sure what I knew at 14. But I did see trotting races, which is a big thing in the East and not out here at all. So my exposure to horse racing goes back many moons. Footnote 26, Sport of Kings. You know what the movies in the 30s were filled with all kinds of things, like not just movies. So you go see two main features and coming attractions. There'd be a comedy of some sort, maybe two, the Three Stooges, something like that. Sometimes they had serials, you know, Buck Rogers. And if you ever have a chance to see any of those early 30s serials, they're really worth watching. They were so atrociously horrible. You can't believe how badly that stuff was done. It's so campy and funny. It's just really wonderful. And they, of course, always ended up the perils of Pauline idea, and then you had the kids, invited the kids to come back and see how that thing. And it'd go on and on and on, chapter 20 or whatever. Chapter 27, Buck Rogers on Gulonium, you know, that sort of thing. So anyway, one of the things they also did sometimes is they had contests. One of the contests, I don't even know what it's even called. Maybe Margaret can help me. But there was a wooden paddle thing and a long rubber string and a ball at the end. And they would have young people go up there and bap, 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 say, who could bat this rubber ball up on this paddle the most times? I think everybody owned one of those maybe in the 30s. The other thing, though, back to Sport of Kings, is they sometimes had horse races in the movies. So there was a short movie thing. I think they even gave out tickets to the, everybody got a ticket that went into the movie, all the kids got a ticket on the winning horse. Of course, there's probably only one ticket on the one winning horse, and you want some sort of a prize. And they had this incredible, it was a funny race, and one of the great lines was, of course, it's girdle and a stretch. Well, you know, and we, you know, you're rooting your horse on, and it was all, not fixed, but predetermined. I mean, whoever won the race was already decided by the Hollywood studio, and whoever had the winning ticket won a bicycle or something. There was only one of those guys, if he was smart enough to keep his ticket. It's Christmas morning. We just finished our breakfast, and I looked around the table, and what we had this morning was what we call fake eggs. They're eggs without the cholesterol or whatever, yolks. They taste pretty good. They're like eggs, but they're not eggs. Who would have ever imagined we would reinvent the egg? Then we had a slice of light bread. We had light whipped butter, and we had all fruit, instead of jelly or jam, all fruits sweetened only with natural fruit juices. So just to think about the breakfast we ate this morning and say a breakfast of 15 years ago or something is significantly different, I think. I was just reminiscing with Margot about when I worked on a farm. I was 14 years old, I think, when I first went to the farm in Cuba, C-U-B-A, New York, over towards the western edge of New York State. We ate the same breakfast. This was an old farmer. He must have been 65 years old, I guess. We ate the same breakfast absolutely every morning, 7 days a week. It was identical. And it was as follows. A big bowl of oatmeal, home-boiled oatmeal, made with really rich, creamy milk because he was a dairy farmer. And a big stack of hotcakes with butter and maple syrup because they had maple trees around there and made their own syrup. And then two fried eggs and a glass of milk, and I think coffee. That was it. Absolutely. Every morning that breakfast, a breakfast of champions, I guess, you'd have to work your tail off not to grow to 400 pounds, but that's in fact what we ate every morning. I'm making this recording. It's December 31st, 1997. It's New Year's Eve. Tomorrow starts a whole new year, and really sort of the end of, I guess, Christmas for us, although a little Christmas tree, which we bought special this year and decorated with lights and bulbs, is still up. What we did this year, we went to Cassie's. We drove over it from Ellensburg to Seattle and stayed there. I had a great time. We visited the Leonardo show and saw the Bill Gates Leonardo manuscript along with paintings and what have you. Quite a show, very busy and filled with people, but we picked a day we just knew nobody would be there. And of course, that was absolutely wrong. It's crammed every day of the year. But it was a fun show to go see. We ate fresh oysters, of course. They're poisoning everybody now with them, but we ate them anyway over in the Brooklyn Oyster House, which is right across the street from SAM, Seattle Art Museum, and a great place. And in fact, I took my brother there. And it's been a little bit of a touchstone for us for now some years. Margot went there with Kathy and ate oysters till they were thrown out of the place. In any case, at Kathy's, we, of course, celebrate too much with food, I guess. Lots of homemade beer. We had a wonderful roast lamb, just absolutely perfect roast lamb, and potatoes baked with cheese, and that was really, really great. Then we planed over from SeaTac to Spokane and sponged off Cindy and her family, and that was a wonderful visit too. And of course, marked by too much eating there, you know, roast beef tenderloin and vegetables and calzone later and clam chowder the next day, and it was just like too much. But it was a really wonderful visit to see them. Ethan was a little bit under the weather, but it's unlikely that one of your kids or the other is not sick during the winter. I was reminded of an expression. I'm not exactly sure how it goes. It was something like shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves of three generations, the implication being, you know, the grandfather works really hard and saves his money and puts his kids through college, and they're really successful and wear ties and suits, and then they have children, and the children are less successful. Of course, it isn't true. It's not a good generalization in any case, although I suppose sometimes it happens. But I thought one of the gift we gave Emma Rose, no less, a jodhpurs. Can you believe jodhpurs? Riding, you know, putty-colored riding pants. Pretty snooty and high class, I would say, as a kid, to be wearing not just blue jeans, but jodhpurs. So, and we gave Ethan a wonderful computer game that's all the rage now, and beautifully illustrated and animated soundtracks, and I tell you the name of it, but I can't think of it. Not Mist, but the Son of Mist. Riven, I guess, or I think Riven, yeah. In any case, it was a great a visit we gave Tom. Brooks Brothers shirt tie, which is pretty, you know, whoa. So it's not shirt sleeves, the shirt sleeves of three generations in any case. It's still riding high. And of course, we're living right now in an economy that's just booming and doing really well, even for retirees. So I think Margo and I end this year, and I said to Margo a little bit earlier tonight, you know, my cup runs over. I don't want for anything. I'm in what I call Fat City, and everything's just coming up roses and all those trite expressions. And Margot agreed, it's true. We're in a really good place, and we're lucky, and we think we're very lucky. It's 1998, January 2nd, I guess. And this is the first year in 118 years that you cannot go to a Woolworth five and dime store. The last of them closed last year after a 118-year run. And you know, in every city and many small towns, I guess, they had a Woolworth store. In fact, the last closure of Woolworths was 400 separate stores. So they were just all over. They were just, I don't know what you'd say, pervasive. And you couldn't grow up in my childhood or young adulthood, or Margo's either, without going to a Woolworth store. They were always Woolworth stores. They were just, you always went there for something, even though they sold lots of junk. But they sold all kinds of things, and they sold everything. And in a way, you know, by the way, I have to tell you, one of the things they sold, turtles. Well, you could always go in and buy a live turtle, get some horrible disease, bring home a horrible turtle disease to your family, but you could buy live turtles there. But they had restaurants, you could eat chicken hamburgers and cream chicken on biscuits and then everything else. And you know, the son of Woolworths, of course, is all these other stores, Target, Kmart to name two. Many of them are bigger than the old Woolworths, but Woolworths was around for a long time and a tremendous money maker. One of the products that I remember Woolworths sold, and I would, on at least a couple of occasions, purchase it for my mother, was they made an, I think, with an orange blossom cologne. And it, thinking about it, it was really horrible. It smelled like sort of what I think now is a urinal cake. But I would buy a little bottle of this cologne for my mother. Oh, she was so happy she got it. And I don't know what the hell she did with it. Threw it out, I guess. But orange blossom cologne. And Margo laughs because she can still smell that scent after all these years. Today, I think, is the 3rd of January, 1998, and Margo and I did the not quite woeful, but a little tinge of sadness. Took down all the Christmas decorations. We had a little tree and took the bulbs off and put them in boxes and took the lights down. And carefully, there's sort of a rule about Christmas. You take your Christmas lights and you make sure that you string them out so they're not, you know, wrinkled up and all that. And then you kind of fold them up sort of like a bed sheet so they're all really neat. And then next Christmas you take them out and there's some little genie that mixes all these cords up, and they're just a mess, and they're all knotted and everything. So how that happens over the summer or what, I don't know. But Margo and I think this was Quentin and Margo's 47th Christmas. Not together, because we missed some. But not bad, in a long time. And then we started thinking about how many Christmases did we have with Cindy and with Kathy. And we were kind of surprised, at least I was a little bit surprised. Margo has a good memory for this sort of thing. And She knew. We haven't missed many Christmases with our two girls. Some of them we didn't, you know, like one comes to mind immediately, 1978. We were in Ireland for Christmas. But, and there have been other times we haven't been together, but rather few. I mean, if you look back on the history of it, you'd say that to be together at Christmas time seems to be an important thing. Here's Exhibit A, and the Exhibit A is we have been together somewhere, either visit all together or visiting each other or something. Of course, it was last year when King Weather took control, and we didn't go anywhere. That's another story. There is, by the way, a rule about Christmas decorations, and that is, and this just is inevitable, that you go around, you get all the Christmas decorations out up where, you know, different pieces, parts of the house and around pictures, and you put them away, and then we like to put them in a nice cardboard box and tape it over with good tape so it doesn't get all gunky and dusty. And Ellensburg can be quite dusty, of course, and but you always forget something. But you also go through this routine about, well, let's look around. I know we've forgotten something, and we did that. What did we forget this year? We forgot the beautiful grape vine wreath that we have outside our front door. Yes, boys and girls, we forgot to do that.
That really doesn't go in with our Christmas tree decoration. We have a separate
place. Okay. Now, the other thing is, I think we should make as a matter of record, backtrack a little bit. Margot and I have never been big New Year's Eve revelers. It's, you know, people like to stay up to midnight and have, I don't know, blow whistles and all that kind of thing. Margot and I have just simply never done that. It's not anything we're sort of interested in. We don't host parties or go to parties on New Year's. And we typically, and we did this year, we were in bed by 8:45 or something like that. I mean, we celebrate, wish each other a Happy New Year the next morning or something. It's just something we've not been interested in doing. And I don't know what that's all about. I do remember, for me at least, maybe the very nicest New Year's Eve thing. We lived in Germany on Nadelbergstrasse, that was the name of it. It was a rock throw away from a large hospital. And the hospital was quite old, it had been there a long time. So this whole area during World War II was never bombed. So we lived in a really nice old, it would still be nice, even 1990, you'd like to live in the apartment we lived in. It was just a wonderful place. It was a four-family apartment with a little balcony and a separate dining room. It was really kind of nice. And it was in this pristine neighborhood because it was never bombed, because it had a big Red Cross on the top, and appropriately it wasn't. Apparently, I kind of recall that all the houses around the hospital were in fact commandeered by the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, German Air Force, and it was housed Air Force pilots. And in fact, where we lived in Furth, there was a large German Nazi, if you will, Air Force base there. So it sounds pretty, the story's probably true. In any case, I remember one New Year's, we lived across the hall from an American man who married a Sudetendeutsch, Sudetendeutsch were the Germans who lived in Czechoslovakia, which of course was a sort of invention of World War I, And the Sudetenland was what Hitler, you know, he claimed it was German. And the people who lived there, the Sudetendeutsch, they said, yeah, we're German. We're not Czechoslovakian. And this is a long political story and inappropriate maybe to discuss right now, but she said, or she was a wonderful person. She was knew all kinds of, all the cultural things or whatever. And she said, when she was young, she ate on New Year's what she called Vienna sausage. And sure enough, she produced them for one New Year's many moons ago in the 50s. And they were long, thin, thinner than hot dogs, maybe by two-thirds of the thickness of an American hot dog, and maybe, again, another third as long. And they were snow white, and I think they were made of veal, and they were steamed or boiled. Vienna sausage, and she said this was a traditional fare for New Year's Eve. And she shared these with us one New Year's Eve, and with champagne, I think, or something like that. It was quite a treat and a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and you wonder if these things still go on. Are you ready to share the... to continue on with the story about the woman from the Sudetenland, she became quite chummy with Margot, and she was a very pleasant young woman. And in any case, Margot will tell a little story about her, she'll tell a little story.
How we met in the first place was she had this huge, big shaver hunk, and I had taken Cindy out for a walk and came back and started up the stairs on this. What started after me, because I was in its territory and it did not know I belonged there. And she heard the dog and came out of her apartment. And she said to me, do you live across the hall? And I said, yes. And she said, well, we have to introduce you to the dog. And she told me to come up the stairs, and the dog had to smell me and smell Cindy and come into our apartment and figure out the whole thing. And after that, we had no trouble with the dog, but it was pretty scary that day. Anyway, that's how we met. And we did kind of become friends, and we went